Hi, welcome to Mixed Identity, the podcast where we collect stories of people who have more than one identity, multiracial, multicultural, or more. I'm your host, Heather Puri, and this is our listener feedback section or listener response section. And today I want to talk about some feedback I got from a wonderful gentleman who I used to work with, and he presents as white, and I found out through this podcast that he's not. I thought he was, but through chatting on Facebook, I discovered that his father is from Puerto Rico, and his wife's father is from Argentina. And they like to call themselves hidden Hispanics, which I thought was fascinating, because I do think in the Latinx culture, there are a lot of people who are received as white. And if you happen to be one of those people whose parents didn't teach you Spanish, or say, which is for some people who are full Mexican or full Latinx of some sort, full Hispanic, there are a lot of people who don't have the Spanish language, which makes them feel less as a lesser Latinx person, or as this gentleman who really said that he actually said, I'm the trifecta. I am cisgender, I am white, and I am male. And so with those three things, he has a hard time talking about his identity because he didn't come from a disadvantage. And I was thinking about that, and I don't want the stories on this podcast to just be about struggle. There's definitely struggle, and we need to acknowledge it and recognize it. And I would say I actually have had very little struggle in my life being a white presenting woman. I didn't experience sexism until I was in my MBA, just because I chose specific female dominated fields. And, you know, I was shocked when it did happen. I was like, whoa. And it was one of those, like you mentioned, idea, and then it gets dismissed, and 10 minutes later it's brought up by a white dude and everyone's like, oh, that's a great idea. So that was my first experience. So I don't actually feel I'm really, really in an advantage position. I have one of the most privileged positions I think there is. I am received as white, and so I can work in those spaces. I have learned how to function, though I'm not always comfortable. I have learned how to function in white spaces, whether that be through my schooling or through my work. I have learned how to function and how to be accepted in those circles. And although I am uncomfortable with it sometimes, I'm not at a disadvantage. And so I actually, on top of that, I have touch with this amazing culture. I have the stories that my mother and grandmother told me. I have more stories that I'm learning. I have the language that I get to sing. This weekend, I got to perform with my 4-year-old, and my 2-year-old did some, he stayed for it and danced and didn't cry. I mean, I am able to share a culture, share something that they are tapped into. In a way that I feel a lot of like generic white people crave, you know, it's why they want to wear headdresses. It's why they want to have spirit animals and those things, which, by the way, I don't do those because that's not my tribe. And I feel like I'm in a super advantaged place, and that my story is still valid, and that these men, white received men of mixed heritage, of mixed race, their stories are valid too. So there was another gentleman who I wanted on, whose perspective, he's as blood quantum wise, he's as native as I am. And I wanted his story because he is not in touch with it in the way that I was, you know. And my theory is still, and it's kind of panning out, that the parent who is more dominant about bringing their culture into the family is the one that a child identifies as more. And we have until even now, I think that we're pushed into boxes, and we choose one or the other. And I don't think that we need to do that. It's in the mixed race Bill of Rights, is that I can be both. and I can associate with both. I don't have to choose one or the other. And I can't remember the specific words of those, but I just, you don't have to choose just white because the world defines you as white. You get to hold on to your heritage. And if you allow them to take your heritage, you're fucking letting them win. You're letting them win. And it's never too late. I think of a good friend who's not such a good friend anymore, but she had started to learn Spanish and really embrace more of her Puerto Rican self. But I would say her father was a white supremacist. He didn't even want to acknowledge that he was Puerto Rican. You know, he didn't teach Spanish in the household. The assimilation was what you did for him and for her family. And she has the advantage of being very comfortable in white spaces, but also she has her right to go learn her language. And I went to a Native American gathering workshop that the Burke Museum put on for those who identify as Native. And you know what? There was a woman there who is just like, I know my grandmother, my grandmother is full-blooded, but she doesn't talk about it. And she, you know, I have no connection with it. And we talked about being urban Indians. And there were those of us there whose parents assimilated because it was safer. But you know what? She's there, probably around my age, maybe a little older. She's there and she wants to learn more about her culture. And we as gatekeepers, or whoever is gatekeepers, I don't think of myself as a gatekeeper to my culture, but maybe I will be one day, that we should not hold back from those people who come, who, you know, maybe all they know is their grandparents' name, and we can help them find their family and help them find their culture. I feel that I feel that there are gatekeepers, at least in my culture, who will keep people out and want to keep it for themselves. And again, I say, fuck that. Like, it doesn't belong to just one person. And so we can't let white people take our culture, and we cannot let people who want to say that they're more of whatever they are than you are. You can't let them. You will find communities that will teach you. I just think I should find the Facebook post and put it on Instagram, but it was just, you know, instead of laughing at those natives in your community who don't know how to hunt or bead or do the native things, instead of laughing at them, why don't you teach them? And if you are a person who knows you have a background, I'm not talking about like, I took a DNA test and I'm, you know, 1000001%, whatever. But if you have that there, that we allow that to go, I mean, because that's what's going to happen. My culture is going to die if I let that happen, right? Like, I'm going to pass it on to my kids, and I hope my kids are going to pass it on. And this culture, these cultures can't die. Like, we can't allow everyone to become assimilated into this generic whiteness that doesn't even have a place, that even white people don't like. Like, hold on to your culture, and you can talk about it. The thing is, the other thing you have to talk about is your privilege. And I use my privilege when I'm in spaces that I can. I use my privilege right now to have the time and effort to make a podcast, right? To raise up these voices. And that when I have, you know, I use my privilege to share my culture with people who may never see my culture and may never know it, right? And like, I do that with my kids' school. And instead of just putting something on just for his classroom, their classrooms, like I say, well, I can do it for the whole school if they want, you know, and use that kind of. And then being able to just step up in white spaces when something is said that's not correct or offensive. And you know what? A lot of white people, they don't even know. That's one thing I'm really realizing about existing in white spaces, is that white people have no idea that there are other spaces that are different. Because if they go into a space, one, they almost never ever go, right? They don't go into non-white spaces. And they don't have to learn to function in those spaces because they don't really ever have to go there. But for people of color to succeed, they have to learn how to exist in white spaces. And so that's a knowledge that I have, and I like to pass it on. I try to do it with my nieces and nephews and even my brothers and sisters when it comes to academia. I know I want to do more of that in my future with Native kids in particular, because that speaks to me. And those are the kids I want to help, right? Like, I'll help anyone, but the people that my heart speaks to is helping Native kids. And so as that goes on, I'm going to help my own kids learn to navigate the white spaces better than I knew how to navigate. And helping white people understand that they have spaces that need to be learned to navigate, that not everyone is born with it. So I'll give a specific example. I went to a diversity meeting, book club meeting through my son's school, and they don't read actual books, articles. So they were talking about whiteness, which I thought was interesting, and I wanted to be there. And so this one mom joined us, and she had kids in elementary school, and she was talking about how the test scores at her school went down, and she's a statistician. I think I may have talked about this before, but if I have, I apologize. I should write down these stories so I don't talk about them again. But she was like, when I broke it apart, what we saw was that, you know, it wasn't the white kids' scores that were going down. It was the kids of color that were bringing all the scores down. And they had had families leave that school because the test scores had gone down. And, you know, test scores in a lot of ways, property values, and there's so many things that are on top of that. And one of the things that I said in there is that you realize that parents of color oftentimes do not know that they need to be highly involved in their kids' schooling. They think, I'm going to send my kids to school and the school is going to take care of them. They're going to let them know what they need. But our schools are not set up that way. You know, you need career counselors who, I don't know about you, but I never had a counselor talk to me about my future and what colleges I was going to go to. It was my parents who did that. My parents who made sure I was in certain classes. Like, I wasn't the brightest of the bright. I wasn't the dumbest of the dumb. I was pretty middle road, maybe a little more intelligent than some others. But my parents helped me navigate middle school and high school so I could go to college, right? And there are a lot of parents that don't know how to help their kids do that, and especially people who have never been to college. And so you think, oh, I'm going to send my kids to school and the teachers are going to take care of them. But our teachers are overworked. There's too many kids in the classroom. College counselors, those kind of counselors, high school counselors, how are they going to help every kid? You know, they look for the brightest of the bright that they can. They know they can make them look good. I mean, I don't know if that, I don't know any ever because I didn't experience that, but there's not enough help, and parents are key. That's why I believe that my brother and I were so successful, even though we didn't go to great schools, because our parents were involved. It's one of the reasons I've decided not to put my kids in private school. Granted, the public school they'll be going to was like a private school compared to the education that I got for the most part. And so it's just there. Use your privilege. I guess that's what I'm saying. We have privilege, and we can help other people navigate that. So whether that's taking the time to help white people understand that they have a space to navigate, whether that's taking the time to help someone understand what they need to do in school to get to college, it can be standing up in a hiring situation. It can be making sure even before the hiring starts, if you're on a board, to say, do we have enough people of color? Like, are we doing that? To be able to submit your friends of color. We know that there's a network of people. And so if you're a person of color and you can help people get in, if you can help them navigate those spaces, then that's great. So yes, we have privilege. That doesn't mean we have to give up the wonderful privilege it is to have our culture. And when you allow your guilt in having white privilege allow you to give up and not be able to talk about the great things about your culture, about being Puerto Rican, about being Tsimshian, about, you know, having a father from Argentina, about having that part of you, I just feel like you're letting the white people win. Not white people, like you're letting the white system win, because a lot of white people are just fine, but you're allowing that white system to win. And we don't want to let that white system win. We want our cultures to thrive and go on. And we want our kids to know who we are and our ancestors and where we came from. And it just makes the world more exciting, right? Like the generic bland whiteness. Even that, like, know about your Polish heritage, know about your German heritage, know about your Irish, like, know about Anglo-Saxon, that kind of stuff. I mean, heck, I'm related to Lord Horatio Nelson, right? Like, that was cool for me to find out. Like, he didn't have kids, but, like, he's, like, my great-great-great-great-great-great-great uncle or something. Like, that's cool. And that's, like, he kicked Napoleon's butt at Waterloo, right? That's cool to know. It's cool to know the stories that made you who you are. And that was from a guest that's going to come up in the next episode. But I'm talking extra long. And my mom told me I talked too long in these sections. Thanks, Mom. We have an amazing, amazing guest after this ad break. A super amazing guest. It is my cousin, Emma Braun. She also goes by M. Braun, and she is just an amazing woman, and the interview is great. She's just a totally different generation than I, and so thoughtful about her identity and thoughtful about the way she goes through the world. She is an amazing woman. So stay tuned for her interview, and I hope you like it. Thanks. When did you decide to go into OBGYN?
I was pretty sure that I was going to go into OBGYN before I even started applying to medical school. I was really interested in women's health, and I'm still really interested in family planning. And yeah, that's kind of what has led me down this path, is the opportunity to do a lot of advocacy work, a lot of public health research, and be able to help women. And I think that that's just awesome. So
I think so too. And this is, so I was messaged you that I just came back from PT.
Yeah.
Do you know one thing that they should tell women about having babies? Like, that's part of family. Is that it totally messes up your body in ways that, like, nobody really let me know. And that's why I'm in PT. 'Cause basically, like, I forgot how to use my tummy, like my diaphragm and all that part of my body. Yeah. So I'm like relearning how to use it, because I spent so long like carrying, like there was something else there, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly. Pregnancy is wild, and nobody tells you things.
No
one tells you what the case of a cesarean section is, like, yeah. No one really talks to you about what to expect after pregnancy or during pregnancy. It's
they don't and even the books and things, I don't know. Do you think people are scared that if women knew what they would go through, then they'd just be like, no.
I think that there's a serious possibility that people would reconsider pregnancy, if, especially people who are kind of ambivalent about having children. I think C-sections are just thought of as like some easy thing. And like, once you see one, you're like, that is not an easy casual surgery. Like, it is a massive abdominal surgery, and it is very underplayed in the media and just colloquially. Yeah. So
yeah, it makes me mad when people are, I was somewhere and they were like, oh, she cheated, she had a cesarean section. And I was like, no, like, that's so much harder to recover from. Like, that's, and I had epidurals for both.
Yeah.
And it was fine. I didn't have a problem. I know a lot of people don't want to do them, one of those being my sister. That's fine. Choose your own way. Epidurals worked for me. So, no, it was super easy. Like, I was really lucky. So if you, Emma, do, your genes are probably also, like, it made it easy, you know? Like, I had an easy pregnancy and I had an easy birth. What was that?
I was a C-section baby, so
yeah, that's
wasn't
true.
Kind to my mom in that, but
but it's hard. It's really tough. Yeah, there's so much, but I'm glad you're going to do it. And I think you're going to make a great OBGYN. Like I have my first doctor that I love so much, and he's our general practitioner. And do you know why I chose him?
Why?
Because his name, like, he has good reviews, and I was in between places. We're moving to Seattle, and I chose him because his name is Eduardo Antonio Miller. Uh-huh. And I was like, dude, this guy's got to be mixed race, so I'm gonna pick him.
Awesome.
And I told him recently, because he's been seeing us since Rihan was born, he sees the whole family. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I picked you because I thought you were mixed race. And he's like, I am. He's Costa Rican and white. And I was like, yeah, your mom totally, like, gave you your, you know, Eduardo Antonio. She wanted you to keep your culture. So that's a good place to shift. Because this is the podcast Mixed Identity, where I, your host, Heather Puri, collect the stories of people with more than one identity. And today I have a super special guest that I'm so excited about. It is my cousin, Emma Braun. And do you go by M now?
I go by Emma or M. I'm good with both.
All right. Yeah. That's like everyone in my family still calls me Hez. And I'm just like, nobody else in the world does. But I'm like, all right. So welcome, Emma. How are you?
Very excited to be here. I'm doing great.
Good. So I am going to, Emma is, as you heard us talking about, she is in finishing up medical school, and she's going to be an amazing doctor. But we always start this question not by what you do for your life, but how do you, Emma, identify to the world?
I currently identify as a cisgender, white passing, indigenous, or Native American, or Native Alaskan woman. I don't have strong opinions on which phrase to use. And I say currently because white passing is something that has been more or less true throughout my life. I was a swimmer and a water polo player for many, many years, and I tan ridiculously quickly. And, or at least I used to. I live in Missouri now, and I'm as pale as I can. And I would definitely burn if I tried to be up in California like I did when I was younger. So currently I'm very pale and definitely identify as white passing, but that is something that has kind of shifted throughout my life. I also identify as a medical student. It's a huge part of my life at this point. And I identify as pro-choice and as a feminist and as an agnostic atheist and a lot of other things. I could keep going, but
I love that. Thank you. You're bringing so many wonderful things, and I have so many questions about so many of those identities. But one thing I want to talk about white passing, because I have always felt in our family, if you think, I mean, other than our cousins, Rob and Mike, who are full-blooded Indian, I still feel like your Facebook photos, I am interested to hear the white passing part of it, or the white presenting, because I see that for myself and I see that for like Ruth, but it was something I was wondering how you were going to do that. And I'd love for you to talk to me a little bit about that white presenting. And I guess that goes into the next question, is like, how has the world identified you?
Yeah.
And it sounds like they often identify you as white.
I think that's changed a lot throughout my life. And I think right now most people identify me as white, but I do frequently get identified as something that I can only really classify as like other. In which people usually just ask where I'm from. But it's interesting because I've gotten a lot of interesting responses to me saying that I'm Native American, which is the phrase I usually go with kind of throughout my life.
Do you want to tell me a story about one, maybe one that has happened recently, or one from you're young, so.
From when I was like in high school. Yeah, I can start one recently. I was on a sub-internship on an OBGYN service, and a patient and her husband, they were a black couple, were sitting down with the physician in his office, And the man and woman were kind of looking at me, and I was smiling at this point. I'd been introduced as Emma, the medical student. Mm-hmm. They were both kind of staring at my name badge, and the woman asked me what my name was, and I said, my name is Emma Braun. And she was kind of looking at me, and she goes, are you Jewish? And I said, well, no, I'm actually Native American. And I will never forget the facial expression on that man's face, because he went from this sense of really intense curiosity to like this proud uncle or something. He just had this huge smile, and we'd already shaken hands, and he took my hand again, and he just gave it like in both of his, and he gave it this good firm handshake. And he and his wife just looked at me, and he was like, I am so proud of you. You are strong. You're going to be a great doctor, a great doctor. And I think about that moment a lot. Because I get looks
it's
like
making
that.
Making me cry.
I get looks like that sometimes occasionally, and I don't know how people are going to react to learning that. And he just looked so proud of me, and that was just such a really great moment, and I was just so happy sitting there. And that's very different from sometimes when I was younger, and I would tell my friends that I was Native American, and sometimes they would say, you know, you can't be Native American because you're too smart. So American, I must be Asian because Asians are smart, and I was smart. And that was, I got that a lot when I was younger. I had other people. There was one dude who was a lifeguard at the pool where I swam, and he asked me what I was. And I said that, you know, after I was really young at this point, and I didn't really understand what that question meant. And after clarifying that he meant, you know, like, what race are you?
Yeah.
I said, I'm Native American. And he said, well, South American. And I was like, no, not South American. My family is from Alaska. And he said, are you sure you're not South American? And I was like, I'm positive. And he's like, so you aren't from Chile. And I was like, no, I'm not. And he was like, Argentina? And I was like, no, my family is from Alaska. And he said, well, no, you can't be from Alaska because all the people there are white.
Man, can you tell people where you grew up so they can put it contextually?
I grew up in San Diego, California, and ended up going to Berkeley for undergrad. So I spent a lot of time in California in my youth, and now I've since moved to Missouri, which is I live in St. Louis, where the city is pretty predominantly it is white and it is black, and there are people obviously who are somewhere in the middle or other races, but the predominant races that you see in St. Louis are white and black.
Yeah. So I was interested in that too, because my brother, your cousin Ken, went to the same school, and I was for his last 2 years of residency, or maybe last year, I was living in Wisconsin, so I'd drive down and visit. And I remember asking him once, I said, okay, so race here, it's really black and it's really white. Exactly. So what do people identify you as? And I'd love to ask you that same question, and then I'll tell you what Ken told me. what do people in St. Louis identify you as?
I think it's just kind of this kind of other or white. A lot of people talk about race issues around me and have on the various like services that I've been on in the hospital. And from that, I think a lot of people identify me as white because they seem to be very comfortable talking about issues and not concerned that they don't offend me. So I take that as being that I think that people identify me as white.
Isn't that weird that they're just like, oh, you're white, so you must be as racist as I am?
Yeah. People will talk about Native issues a lot of the time, and I'm just kind of sitting there like, cool. I don't feel like chiming in at the moment because I know that you're grading me.
That's true. There's a
very interesting dimension to it, knowing that most of the people that I interact with at these days are grading me. And so when I disclose that information, it can sometimes go in a really interesting direction. Sometimes I think identifying yourself as Native to a lot of white people invites the question in which you are asked to speak on behalf of all Native people. Those are always really hard questions. And I'm usually like, Well, I didn't grow up on a reservation. And so I feel like my experience is very different than a lot of other people's experiences. And for that reason, when I was young, I had a hard time identifying as Native because I felt like I wasn't
Native enough
to be able to claim that.
Yeah. And do you know that 70, it's between like 70, maybe 60 to 80. I'm going big because I can't remember the exact number of us are urban Natives. Yeah. And I think that's, again, a story that's missing from the narrative of our world, because most of us are learning to interact. And I wonder, too, if your socioeconomic status has, that's one thing that's always been hard for me, because when people think of Natives or people of color, they put them into typically a socioeconomic class that neither you and I, well, neither you, I don't think, spent any of your life in a lower socioeconomic class. No. Yeah, because your parents like waited to have kids and didn't have like 1,000. So. Yeah.
My mom was 36 when she had me, so.
Yeah, exactly. So there, it's, yeah, your mom was my mom idol. Like, I still fashion myself after, I hope my kids turn out as awesome as you and Noah. Well, your mom and your dad. And so, do you think that was part of it too, is like, identifying, is it, I find it now sometimes more difficult, to identify as a person of color in certain environments, because actually to other people of color, because I'm so white presenting and because I now exist in a higher economic class. Do you think that had anything to do with how you identified when you were younger and not being as comfortable as identifying as Native?
I think, especially when I was younger, I didn't know any other Native people besides our family.
Yeah, that's true.
And so in my head, it was really just us and the people who still lived in Metlakatla.
Yeah. And
I had a hard time feeling like I was a part of that community because, and saying that I was part of that community because, and this has happened to me a lot. Sometimes I will say that I am Native Alaskan and people say, oh, so you grew up in Alaska.
No. Yes. Yeah. No.
And some white people will then respond by saying, well, you can only say that if you're a local.
Yeah.
And then I kind of get into this weird space where I do often question that in myself. Like, can I say that if I didn't grow up there? And what I've learned kind of moving through a lot of the kind of white predominant academic spheres is that I learned when I was pretty young that if I wasn't talking about those issues, that nobody was going to be talking about those issues, because very few people are able to permeate into that space. And so in the last few years of my life, I've become much more comfortable talking about those issues because I know that there isn't somebody else who they is more Native who can talk about these things because they haven't been invited to the table.
Yes.
To create a space where they can be invited to the table and where they are. People me have to talk. And so
that's
where I am now in terms of that.
Well, I'd like to go into that because I think one of the identities, you didn't mention this, but it's something I think about when I think about what you're doing. But I think you've been really getting involved in activism.
Yes.
And so, like, I'd love to talk about that and how your identity, which, by the way, we should say your dad is German, right? Like a German background, I think.
Miscellaneous white folks is kind of.
Okay, yeah. And probably one of the nicest men on the planet.
Yeah.
you have a very great dad. So how has your identity and your and the privilege that comes with being white presenting, like, assisted you, or like, how has like your journey into becoming an activist? Because I think it's very interesting. I hear a lot of what you're saying of being that person who can be at the table and who can say things for the, I always like, and this is a big, I say for the others, like everything I do in my life is for the others, which means not white people. because I have the privilege, I have white privilege. So then I can then, whether it's in hiring practices or in my creative endeavors and those things, be able to, so, and I include in that like all like LGBT and women and basically not white men, I guess. I should be cisgender white men to get like very, very specific. So who have lots of money, because I'll totally like poor white dudes, I can help them out too if needed. But how has your identity influenced you as an activist and your work that you're doing with that?
Yeah. One of the spaces that I have been able to be in a lot is advocating for reproductive justice. And that is something that's important to me because I recognize that being able to access those things is something that people who live with money will always be able to get into those spaces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people who don't are the ones that are left struggling. Yes. And that is one of the things that I am most interested in doing with my career, is allowing people to just have the opportunity to make decisions for themselves without the state making decisions for them, because people who are rich will be able to make those decisions without the state playing a huge role in that. Again, I live in Missouri, which is a very restrictive state, and where access to just getting to an OBGYN doctor who can perform all of the counseling options that should be available to any woman of reproductive age is difficult. And that's where a lot of my activism comes into, because I think when people are able to make reproductive decisions for themselves, they are able to pursue careers that they want to and pursue their education, and they are able to more easily move through life.
Yes.
At their own speed and just make their own reproductive decisions. And so that's something that I think just allowing people that kind of freedom allows them to make decisions for their lives. And some people have very different trajectories that they wish that they could pursue, and just letting people make those decisions for themselves is something that's really important to me. And that's a huge part of why I want to go into the career that I want to go into.
Mm-hmm.
Is just being able to speak for people who don't get a seat at the table. And for me, a lot of that has been, I've had the opportunity to go to Jefferson City, which is the capital of Missouri, and speak in front of the state Senate and the state House of Representatives, and speak for women who don't know that they even need medical services yet. And create, or at least advocate for, pathways that allow them to move through the medical system more easily.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, advocate for universal healthcare coverage, and for people who, you know, have difficulty navigating through the medical service. And one of the things I'm currently interviewing for residency programs, and something that's super important to me, is just working with a diverse population of underserved mm-hmm. people. That's why I went into medicine. I want to be able to help people navigate the system and be someone who is compassionate and warm and listens to people and meets them where they are in life. And I think especially when it comes to reproductive care, there's a lot of mistrust in the medical system with regard to that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult, the system that we have for not only reproductive rights, but for everything is. So, I mean, even I, who have like 2 degrees, and there are times I struggle with navigating the system and understanding like what are the questions. Like I feel lucky there are oftentimes I have just turned to my brother, who, you know, has no to understand what's going on, like with it in so much. And like right now we are going through some it, and it's not just in our country that it's so convoluted. It's even in, so my mother-in-law is needs to have like a major surgery for her uterus, because nobody talks about how kids destroy your body.
Kids
are wonderful, but I am doing PT, so I will not have to have surgery on my uterus one day. But like, we can't even, it's like the only way to find, to know you're going to have a good doctor is you have to know someone who like works in that hospital, and you have to like trust their judgment. It's just, it's such a convoluted field for everyone. And then to take it from people who are not educated and haven't learned how to navigate white spaces, and to get white people to understand that not everyone understands their space. Like, it's not, it's like academia for me was not natural. And even now I'm just like, that's more of a space that I want to get into. I want to help Native kids understand academia, because it's a game and it's a white space and white people know how to play. Not all white people, we will say a certain level of socioeconomic class, like they know the game that is academia, or for you medicine. And it just really I think speaking up about, like, because white people don't get that. They don't understand that not everyone grew up understanding certain spaces. And when it comes to academics, we were talking about, so I live in one of the nicest neighborhoods in Seattle because the schools are great, blah, blah, blah. And we were talking about this one school whose test scores went down, you know, and the this woman who's a statistician and went and looked at the numbers, and it was the white kids' numbers were fine, you know, in math, but it was the kids of color who were bringing the whole number down. And there were white parents who were taking their kids out of these schools because the test scores went down. And just in that space, I said, do you know, a big part of it is that your children have you as an advocate. Most parents of color don't understand that they need to be their child's advocate at school. They actually think, I'm going to send them to school and the teacher is going to be there to help them in the way they'll help everyone. And helping white people, because I exist pretty much only in white spaces. I live in Seattle. Come on, you guys. And I feel that that's part of my is educating white people that not everyone knows how to move through their spaces. And if you truly want to be an anti-racist, you will acknowledge that and make space, like you've been saying, invite them to the table and educate them on how to move through this space and provide resources for those parents and those children, because oftentimes they can't, depending on their, you know, socioeconomic class, like they can't be there to help their kid with the homework at night or, you know, afford that extra tutoring. You know, it's not like they're any less skilled, but yeah, I feel you a lot in the, and I love that you're going into that with medicine, 'cause it is intimidating even to me. And, I have a cousin and a brother who are doctors, and I'm still intimidated by the medical field.
Medicine is confusing, and there are really big decisions that people have to make, and it's hard to understand the consequences of those decisions. And sometimes you don't have a month to do research and sit down and contact everybody that you know to be able to make those decisions, and to have a doctor who sits down and finds the time in our, you know, what will be incredibly busy lives to make sure that their patient understands what they mean, and they aren't just nodding yes because that's what they think they're supposed to do.
Because there's such a level of power as a doctor. Like, there's so much power in that role. So good. But I'm gonna switch gears just a little. And I just want to ask you about sometime you talked about this a little when you were younger in the lifeguard, but I'd love to hear kind of that understanding when, or if you did, and I'm finding out a lot of people don't, but they're like, oh man, my parents, my family is different from everybody else's family in the sense, and maybe you're about a decade younger than I am, a little more than that. So maybe you had more mixed friends, But I, other than my brothers and sisters, right?
Yeah.
I could count my mixed race friends on two fingers, you know, growing up. But did you ever have that moment where you were like, whoa, there's not a lot of people whose parents are actually different from each other?
Yeah. I grew up in an area that is predominantly white, and almost all of my friends when I was younger were white. And I don't remember how old I was, but I think just realizing that I was one of the few people I knew whose parents both worked, and that whose mom was also very involved at my school.
Yes.
She made time for my education, and she was the parent teacher association president as a working mom, and was one of the few people who made sure to be so involved in my school.
Mm-hmm.
And was also working and was also not a white woman, and just realizing how important it was for her to create opportunities for her children was something that I kind of appreciated as a kid, but so much more appreciate now as an adult looking back at that.
Mm-hmm.
Just how different that was to other families.
Yeah. So your mom said it still sticks with me. So I used to come down when I was in undergrad, I would come down and visit one sometimes. And I remember her just saying, sitting there, and she goes, "Do you know, Heather, this feminist lied to us. You can't have it all." And for her to be honest, to say, because she, if any woman made it look like she could do everything, your mom made it look like that. I mean, she was editor of the Union Tribune. She like had a great career, had was so involved in your, you know, as you said. And she says it's so hard. She said, you're not 100% at work. You're not 100% at when you're at home. Like it's always too much. And I truly believe, as raising a mother of two boys, that it's my job to make sure that they understand that they can have their care responsibility can be the same. Does that make sense? And I do struggle right now because I am a stay-at-home mom. It's one of parts of my identity that's really hard. I also picked an industry that makes no money at all. And people actually joke, like, the only way you can work in nonprofit arts is if you have a partner who will support your habit. My husband was like, yeah, you can keep working. And I just had a horrible boss, so I ended up leaving. But it's a struggle for me to have my son say, why don't you go to work? Because I want to model for them that men can also be caregivers and play caregiving roles, because I think that's the big change that has to happen. So it can be truthful, because a man gets to have it all. I mean, a man gets to be a father without it really hurting his career in any way. And so I think when we can teach men, and I think part of it, I don't know, I am an outsider in your family's perspective, but I do feel like your dad was a more involved dad.
Yeah.
As well.
My parents, I remember there were certain days of the week when I was a kid where one parent would be home, and when we got home from school, and every day around 4:30 or 5, we would all get in the car, and whoever was home would drive to work, because my parents worked at the same place.
Yeah.
And the other parent would be waiting outside the building, and the other person would get in the car, the other person would go back to work, and we would drive back home again. And that was a you know, weekly ritual. I think it was Mondays and Wednesdays or something. And they just would trade off. And that was just always the way it was they would spend the same amount of time at home and same amount of time at work. And, you know, that was varied from a weekly basis. But my dad was always very involved in being at home. And that's just something that I appreciate so much and about my parents.
Yeah. And it's modeling that behavior that I think is important, for which is why I have this podcast and the things that like I'm going to continue the work that I have. And that's what I tell Rehan. Like, I do have work, you know, like I do take care of you and I don't go to an office, but I still have work. And allowing boys to be really into pink. Do you know, this is my favorite story. I went on Facebook and looked at pictures of Noah and thank God he had like pink shoes and a pink shirt on. Because Rehan, you know, he's 4 and he's learning these gender stereotypes from, you know, his friends at school who say, oh, pink is a girl's color. And I was like, no, you have a strong, tough boy uncle who loves pink too. And I think your parents just did a good job. Anyway, and let me see, do I have any, is there anything else you want to share before we go, just about your identity or anything that's important or links to any kind of activist things that you think my listeners should know about as when it comes to family planning and reproductive care, if there's anything, because that's a huge thing that's going on right now, especially in the South and with the current climate that we have politically. I think it's very important for people to understand, and I know I've heard of some, but that you can go and like basically programs, you can give money so people who have less resources can still access what rich people can get. But is there anything you want to share?
Yeah, one kind of nonprofit that I've worked with through my time in Missouri, it's called the Gateway Women's Access Fund. And they help, they're a nonprofit that organizes to collect money to help women who are trying to access the full spectrum of reproductive care in Missouri and are unable to do so. We have a lot of laws in Missouri that make it very difficult to access family planning resources. And that is a great fund that helps women who have to travel across the state to be able to access care, and is an amazing organization that I would definitely recommend you check out. Their website is just www.gwaf.org.
Great. And I'll put it on the website and in the show notes. And so thank you, Emma. It's such a delight. I wish life was not so busy. I think half the reason I started this podcast is so I can just talk to my family. But so we end with just one thing. I like to share something that I'm really into right now, and it doesn't have to be, I used to say something that brings you joy, but I realize like the things that I'm really into rarely bring me joy in like a way of intellectual stimulation or, but aren't just joy. I think people read it as what makes you happy, which is not, I don't think the same as joy. And so I'm going to share it's a person today, and then you can share, something that you're really into. But I have recently discovered Andre Henry. He was, on this podcast that he's a anti-racist activist, which I really like how he talks about that, because it's not just social justice, it's anti-racism. And he does he just has a really great way of talking about the system and how the system is racist, and that if we're not actively fighting the system, then we are complicit in that racism. And even if we don't think ourselves as racist, like we're too nice of people to be racist, our actions can be. And so he has a podcast called Hope and Hard Pills. And the podcast I heard him on was the Litter Dish. I can't say it, but I'll put it in my show notes and on the website, a link to both of these. But I think he was able to articulate things that I have. I don't know if you've been going through this in this climate, and just maybe I'm willing to speak up more to my white friends, but there are times I find it hard to articulate what I'm saying. So I had a friend, a really good friend who I know loves my son so much, tell me that we had a big discussion about race, and she was like, I don't see your sons as brown. And I was like, why is there something wrong with being brown? And she just, I really tried to help her understand, like, that colorblind perspective is just very harmful. And anyway, Andre Henry was able to put word, like, I want to send her the podcast because I tried to send her an article because I couldn't put into words why that, why being colorblind and why saying my kids, she doesn't see my kids as being brown is a harmful, is racist and harmful to my children because they're brown and there's nothing wrong with that. And by saying there that she doesn't see him as that, she sees him as a typical norm white. It's harmful. So anyway, I will link to him. He just, it's, his work is great. It's very focused, which I think is totally reasonable on like black social justice issues, but I think it speaks to all people of color. And one of the things one of his guests said was just when you help, and she's like, all I do is focus on black women and I'm never going to apologize for that. But if you help those who are least in our system, it's going to benefit everyone. And I truly believe that. So even if you're not, you know, a black activist, I think you can listen to this and learn a lot from it. So that's something that's just making me think a lot. Yeah. And what do you have, Emma, to share?
Yes, that sounds awesome. And I will definitely check out that. So I'll do two things. One thing that actually brings me joy is I've been on the interview trail and I've been traveling a lot. And I am loving that way more airports are just offering like free Wi-Fi all the time as opposed to the like you get 30 minutes, then you have to pay for it afterwards because I've had a lot of delays. It's been really helpful to be able to get work done in the airport. I get unlimited free Wi-Fi. So that has been giving me joy.
But, I love that.
A book that I read recently that I just finished reading. Listening to, I've been into audiobooks because I can't read on public transportation without getting really nauseous. Mm-hmm. But I've been listening to Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill, which was kind of exploring sexual harassment in Hollywood and in the workplace, and was just a really fantastic book that I would definitely recommend anybody to check out, which definitely did not bring me joy. It was a very sad and difficult discussion to have to listen to that what people have had to go through in their careers at the hands of really powerful men. But I think it's definitely, it was a really great book and I'm really glad for the people who are brave enough to do that kind of work. So that's what I've been enjoying recently.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for, being on my podcast.
Yeah,
and Oh, it was great to hear, and I'm super proud of you, too.
listeners, if you've made it this far, I want to ask you a favor. If you could go over to Apple Podcasts and put a review and what you think of Mixed Identity, that would be super helpful. Again, if you have any thoughts of the episode that you just heard, you can check us out at Facebook at Identity Mixed or Instagram at Identity_Mixed. And I'd love to continue this conversation. Our theme music is Ice Flow by Kevin McLeod, licensed by Creative Commons. It can be found at filmmusic.io or incomtech.com.